Good morning. Fashion may be about making a personal statement. For fashion designers, it's also about making a career. In this Fashion Month, we'll look at the growth of the industry with Hawaii Fashion Incubator co-founder Toby Portner. Automation has already changed industries, including fashion. How it's changing sectors is the subject of our ongoing series, The Last Job in Hawaii. Today, State Human Resources Director James Nishimoto spotlights a place where more traditional jobs may last longer. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. Musician Rachel Flowers is the subject of a new documentary film, Hearing is Believing. She and her director are with us in our studio. And Oscar-winning producer Nicole Rockland knows from Glass Ceiling. She's in town to encourage young women to follow her lead.
It's Thursday, November 10th. That's The Conversation, right after this news.
Good morning and welcome to The Conversation on this, the 241st birthday of the Marine Corps.
That's right.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
And that's going to mean something to you, especially these days, too.
Got a concert coming up. That's right.
Good. Well, we'll talk more about that as it gets a little bit closer.
Yeah.
But good morning to you, too. Now, this morning, we are still coming out of the election. A lot of people are still thinking about that. But, you know, in many ways, for a lot of people, life has to go on and things that have been planned well in advance, including
what we're
going to talk about first this morning. Now, if you're into label looking, you may see many new Hawaii fashion designers showing up in stores. That the once robust Hawaii fashion industry is now making a comeback is due in no small part to the Hawaii Fashion Incubator, known as HIFI. It started 10 years ago to connect people with resources to achieve their fashion industry goals. In 2013, HIFI helped to designate Fashion Month, November, to focus collective attention on our local fashion community. Along with Melissa White, Toby Portner is the co-founder of HIFI. She joins us now with this year's update on the Hawaii fashion industry. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann. Thanks for having me here.
Well, as we've been following this over now, you know, what, four successive years, to see how this has grown and who is a new player in town and what this means for an industry as a whole, it looks very different from, you know, the days back when where you had kind of Malia everywhere and Mamo and other things that were very narrowly based. Now we're seeing fashion that moves all through, and I mean, not just surf fashion or things that you would wear casually, but all kinds of beautiful fashion done by Hawaii designers. What's the big difference that you see between when we talked last year and this year?
Well, I think there are a couple things. One is people are more aware. They're more aware of the brands that are available because they're at more stores and available to more people more readily. And also, I think social media has helped that. So people are looking for designers to shop, and they're aware of who they are and have been following them. And the second thing is that centers, for retail centers, are supporting local designers by building a doable marketplace opportunities. So enabling a smaller company to jump in a way that lets them focus on growing their business without a lot of overhead and providing them a platform to really show what they do and show it well.
I mean, it's wonderful when you can be a company like, you know, Fighting Eel and have your own independent store. But for a lot of newer designers to be able to be part of a collective that also has retail space has been a real difference. And we're going to see that in Kaka'ako opening very soon.
Yeah, we sure are in a couple of locations. So, of course, there's Salt in Kaka'ako that actually they had an event last night. And then we're very excited about the South Shore Market opening at Ward. Ward has been a giant supporter of this whole resurgence in the industry, if we can call it that. And to that end, they've built a permanent space into the area that they enabled us to use the first year and kind of test things out with outfit the marketplace, so that now that they're able to provide an experience-based shopping experience for for everyone to see who's out here and what they're doing. And as I said, there's a range. So there are more established companies and then there are smaller ones. And we're excited to see everybody sort of shift over there and get to spend some time. In addition to the shopping, they'll have platforms for learning and presentation by other designers because, of course, our community grows because everybody inspires each other.
When you look at some of the legacy fashion houses still here, think about, you know, Iolani, others, what's the difference between what they've been able to do to stay here and still be part of the scene and be able to compete with some of the newer, younger designers who are coming along with some very different ideas?
Well, it's interesting because there's that idea of competition and then this co-opetition kind of a concept where those legacy designers that have been around for a long time have enjoyed success and a large following and are able to stay doing what they're doing despite new people coming along. And many of them have provided inspiration and opportunity to the up-and-coming designers such that while it builds a healthy competition, it also just grows what's available and it puts more of an emphasis on supporting local. So everyone wins in that way.
A few years ago, when all of, you know, the runway shows and a lot of the discussions and workshops were being held in that space that the South Street Marketplace is now going to be occupying, there was a real emphasis on a lot of accessories, jewelry, you know, beautiful things, but not this full range and full expression of designers. It seems to be happening this year. What became that pivotal point that made it really accessible for designers who live in Hawaii, where we don't have a giant manufacturing industry, where people were even concerned a few years ago about who really knows how to cut and who really knows how to sew and you know, create patterns, that this seems to have changed so much?
Well, I mean, I hate to be simplistic about it, but I think a lot of it is time. You know, if a company is given an opportunity to show and sell what they do, however small, and from that comes a return enough to then turn around and take the next step, however small that is. Maybe it's looking for someone to do their samples locally so there's more of an oversight so it expedites the process and gets them into production more quickly so that then they can show in the next marketplace opportunity. When there are pieces in place that speed up the progress and people are doing it 3, 4, 5, 6 years in a row, it enables them to grow. And so sometimes it's just that. And many of the smaller companies have been around for more years than all of us are aware because they were working on a very small scale for several years. And it wasn't until 2, 3 years ago that we saw them as an emerging small company, and now they continue to grow.
So who would you put on that list?
Well, my favorite that I jump to all the time is Rumi Murakami. She has beautiful clothing made for real women, adults, who have a unique sense of style and yet like to dress in an appropriate professional way. I've really seen her line evolve and develop. We see, of course, I always go back to Manuhe Ali'i, and they've been around for a long time, and though they have styles that endure, everything changes in just enough of a way to keep it fresh and with the times. And I love to see a new enthusiasm around their line, younger people wearing it. And so, you know, all the platforms that enable people to show what they're doing exposes more people and the audience grows.
Do you see a time where we're going to have a Hawaii fashion industry that looked similar to what folks maybe remember from the 70s and the 60s when the movie really began to bloom?
I laugh because people ask that question all the time, and it's hard. I think it's a trick question in a way, because if we're counting on going back to what we remember from the past, I don't think we're going to get there. in terms of the amount of enthusiasm and awareness on the local industry, that I think we can
replicate. I mean, not stylistically, but in terms of just the real awareness of all of this and understanding that we have, you know, quite a presence in fashion.
I think so. Definitely a presence. I think there's potential for that. It was different back then because what we produced was unique because in the general marketplace, we didn't see a lot of that. And there's a lot more competition now, which at any rate, we're moving forward. So we look forward to seeing everybody grow and for this to continue.
With designers that are producing fashion that can be universal and found maybe all over the United States and all over the world. Thanks so much for coming in. Looking forward to seeing how this continues to grow.
Yeah, see you this month.
Toby Portner is the co-founder with Melissa White of Hi-Fi, the Hawaii Fashion Incubator. More about Hawaii Fashion Month and Honolulu Fashion Week, which is this week. All those activities are listed on our Facebook page, Hawaii Conversation.
What the Commander-in-Chief wants, the Commander-in-Chief gets.
If a military leader is in a position that they disagree with those orders, they have one choice, and that is to walk away.
The delicate push and push back in President-elect Trump's new relationship with military leaders. That's next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, right after The Conversation.
You're listening to The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. It's 8:15. Coming up, Rachel Flowers live in our studio. But first, here's your backyard quiz.
In today's backyard quiz, we're cultivating our crops. Pineapple, coffee, and sugarcane were first commercially planted in 1825 as an experimental venture in Manoa Valley by two men. 3 years later, some coffee trees were taken to the Manoa plantation in the Naole area of Kona. Due to the rich soil, consistent cloud cover, and elevation, coffee thrived and continues to be a commercial crop in Kona. By 1842, Big Island coffee trees had made their way to Kauai, where a plantation was started in Hanalei, and a second followed in 1847. For today's backyard quiz, can you tell us who the original transporters were? We'll add the cream and sugar in the second half of the show. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. And the first one to get it right gets the T-shirt.
Aloha, I'm Chris Pierce from The Joy of Sake. You're tuned to HPR2, Hawaii Public Radio. Learn more about what you hear on the show at facebook.com/HIConversation.
Performing artists, if they are wise, learn to turn the adversity in their lives into fuel for their creative passion. That's what Rachel Flowers has done. She was born prematurely, losing her sight when she was very young. She channeled her energy into music, becoming a skilled multi-instrumentalist and authentic prodigy whose story is told in a new documentary film, Hearing is Believing. She's here in the studio, and we welcome her. Good morning, Rachel.
Good morning.
Thanks for coming in.
Mm-hmm.
Music really kind of fuels your life, doesn't it?
Yeah.
When did that start for you?
I don't really know. I just remember when I was very little, I would always listen to my mom or dad or cassette tapes that had a lot of their own songs, and or other times it's just a whole bunch of things. So,
were they musicians, your parents?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my mom and dad both write songs and play instruments, piano and guitar.
So there were instruments in the house. That's a big help, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. A lot of keyboards and piano. Yeah.
For keyboard, is that a good instrument? Just thinking in terms of any young musician who wants to start out, is a keyboard a good way to start out?
I think keyboards is, that's pretty much where you can sort of get an idea of what different instruments sound like. But then it's nice playing the piano, getting the action on the instrument and the certain qualities that most keyboards don't really have. And some of the keyboards now are amazing, like Nord and some Korg keyboards, that they're bringing that thing that real pianos have, which is pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
That's always been the complaint with electronic instruments, that they just mm-hmm. didn't have that quality of a good Steinway or the
Bösendorfer.
Yeah. You got a chance to play our Bösendorfer upstairs yesterday.
Yeah, that was pretty cool.
Well, you know, the thing you get back from a good sounding instrument is that it's kind of a source of inspiration in itself, isn't
mm-hmm.
it?
Yeah.
What got you started writing music?
I don't really know exactly what started me into writing.
But it's sort of, well, it's right there under your hand, so I guess ideas can flow pretty naturally just when you're kind of experimenting, yeah?
Yeah, it's part of experimenting. And sometimes when I would be asleep, I would have these dreams and I would hear little song fragment ideas, and I would record myself singing it so I could finish the piece.
I've heard other musicians say that they dream an idea and even, you know, keep a little recorder mm-hmm. handy for things like that.
Yeah.
Kind of makes you wonder what the source of ideas is, doesn't
mm-hmm.
it?
Yeah. Sometimes it's like after I listen to a certain style or an artist.
Mm-hmm.
Like one time I was listening to, I think it was Stevie Wonder and Prince, two different artists and multi-instrumentalists. And then I had this dream that this song was, it was just a little brief quote, but it had this mixture of Stevie and Prince. And then I finished it the next day.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, both of those musicians had that thing of seeing the whole, you know, seeing the song whole from mm-hmm. top to bottom. Yeah.
Yeah. And
playing all the instruments. And that's kind of what you've set out to do as well. Yeah.
Yeah. Yep.
But for that requires, I guess you would think of it as having a kind of a composer's mind in terms of seeing mm-hmm. how different things are going to fit together. Not everybody can see the whole picture like that.
Yeah. It is very interesting.
Well, you know, a lot of people who want to become musicians worry about having a gift.
Mm.
And it sounds as if you clearly started out with a real gift, but you had to supplement it with practice, didn't you?
Yeah, a lot of practice to get better, gradually expanding, and yeah.
As you get better technically, you mm-hmm. know, able to do more with whatever instrument, does that sort of expand your thoughts creatively, give you more possibilities?
Yeah.
So where do you take that now with your music? What kind of things are you looking to say and express with your music?
Not really sure. That's hard.
It is hard, yeah. It's kind of one of the harder challenges a musician faces, but maybe I guess the music itself can pull you along, yeah?
Yeah. Sometimes, most of the time I would be listening to some artist or... And I'd go, okay, I like that, but I like to expand on that idea or something that sort of has that style.
Mm-hmm.
Like one time I was listening to Jaco Pastorius, and on his word of mouth recording, there are a couple songs that have orchestra and sort of a choir.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I was I had this idea of coming up with a piece of music sort of like that, but that also featured more vocal roles as well, instead of just a few bars. So on my first CD, I don't know how to... There's a piece called Aloha.
Mm-hmm. That uses that same idea, interacting with voices.
Yeah, an orchestra and fretless bass.
Well, you know, Jaco's Pastorius is a pretty good example of a musician who's inspired a great many succeeding generations and kind of taken his instrument, electric bass, further than a lot of people thought it could be taken.
Yeah, as a lead instrument playing Charlie Parker and then playing chords.
Yeah.
Yeah, and playing with Joni Mitchell and all these exciting lead roles and Weather Report.
You know, it sounds, Rachel, as if you've been able to draw a lot of inspiration from other artists that you've heard.
Mm-hmm.
And it also sounds as if that you can get inspiration by just taking maybe, as you described, one little element and then taking off from there, yeah?
Yeah.
Well, it's great to have you in Hawaii. And
yeah, pretty exciting.
First time?
First time here in Hawaii, yeah.
Well,
pretty cool.
Let's hope you come back. And thanks so much for coming in.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Rachel Flowers is a musician and the subject of Hearing is Believing, a feature-length documentary that will be shown this Friday at 1:30 p.m. at the Regal Dole Cannery Theaters in Honolulu as part of the 36th Hawaii International Film Festival.
Hawaii Public Radio wishes to thank George Scheib of Captain Cook, Elmer Nakasato of Hawaii, and Brian Riley of Kailua Kona for their recent membership gifts. We'd love to see all Big Island supporters at a Pauhana celebration of our newest transmitter, KAHU 91.3. We'll be in Hilo on November 18th. And for ticket information about the East Hawaii sign-on party, look under events on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org. We hope to see you.
Support for The Conversation comes from Bank of Hawaii Private Banking, where a personal relationship manager and financial services team provide custom solutions. Learn more about Bank of Hawaii Private Banking at boh.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
This morning, the president and the president-elect met to talk over a smooth transition come January. The change of party in the White House has left many Hawaii Republicans feeling vindicated, but what policy changes might affect Hawaii are still the subjects of conjecture. Welcome to Trump World. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has a reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
You know, we're still kind of in the very new days of looking at all of this, but as you've been looking and assessing what might come down the path, what's in it for Hawaii come January and beyond?
Well, first of all, a very big caveat. Donald Trump may say one thing and then do another. As you know, he has a habit of changing his mind a lot, and so this is highly speculative. But what we did do is we took a look at his past policy statements, what he has said while he ran for president, and what he said on election night, actually. And remember, he's going to have a GOP Congress to work with. All three branches, or rather two branches controlled, and probably the third eventually, by Republicans. But let's just look at a couple of things. On election night, he talked about infrastructure, getting highways and airports and schools and other areas up to par. Think about Hawaii. We've got a terrible problem with potholes, sewer problems.
Bridges.
The bridges, absolutely. Yeah. Think about the rail line. Might an FTA under President Trump be more receptive to helping Honolulu build its rail line? Veterans. Trump has talked a lot about reforming the VA, the Veterans Administration. We've got over 127,000 veterans in Hawaii and the Pacific Basin. And as you know, they need medical care. Trump has said he's going to fire people at the VA who are not going to do a job. So these are just a couple examples, and I can name some more, where, you know, on the positive side, perhaps Trump might make some changes beneficial to Hawaii.
You know, one of the things that we talk about fairly much these days, obviously, is the issue of terrorism and who comes in, who comes out. Hawaii is unique in the way that, you know, we are positioned in the middle of the Pacific. We are an island state. Anything that he has said about that and homeland security that might have particular ramifications for Hawaii?
Yeah, absolutely. He's talked about having a biometric entry exit visa tracking system. That's a complicated phrase, but essentially knowing more about who comes in, who goes out. Obviously, Trump has talked about building a wall along Mexico. He's anti-immigration. In this regard, this exit system would be at all air, land, and seaports. Mm-hmm. Well, we're a tourism state. We get a lot of international visitors here and for business as well as tourism, and that could be detrimental to our number one economy. On the bright side, if you can look at it that way, if there were less immigrants coming to Hawaii, that might help with our housing system, given that there's very little of it. But as you know, we're also very proud of our immigrant background. That's what we are here in Hawaii, and frankly, the U.S. in general, a nation of immigrants.
And of course, we got to go in just a second, but our whole issue with health care that has been so, you know, much a landmark for the rest of this state, or a benchmark at least for the rest of the U.S. Well, we're going to see how this plays out. Obviously, this is just a lot of conjecture now, but worth taking a look at. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Bethann.
Talk to you tomorrow. Chad Blair joins us every day with a reality check. A few weeks ago, we began a series considering the effect of automation on employment. In our first segment of The Last Job in Hawaii, we talked with the think tank head, Jerry Michalski, one of the contributors to the Pew Research Center's Future of the Internet project. Few human resource departments or firms are focused on the transition from human jobs to automation, a big mistake, according to Mr. Michalski. He also said the same could be said of most education systems, meaning that people now or soon to be in school may learn how to function in a workforce that will see dramatic change in the next 15 years, but they may not be ready for it. But one place that has already shown to be slower in the automation uptake is government. And that could mean the last job in Hawaii could be in state government. I sat down with James Nishimoto, the director of the Department of Human Resources Development, who looks at it this way.
We're not any different in terms of the same types of jobs that they have in the private sector are similar to the jobs that we have in the state sector. So what we end up doing is having to prepare for the fact that all of our jobs basically are going to be evolving. Many of the systems that heretofore have been manual are now electronic. Many of the systems that we're looking at taking advantage of, heretofore we've had using a form. Now we're looking at online input. So we're having to have the employees to be able to have a conversation with a technology specialist who has then the ability to design and program these types of online applications. We're not immune to what's happening in the private sector. And in fact, because of the intensity of administration and documentation on the public sector, we're probably more affected by a lot of the technology.
That sounds to me, you're really saying that you are doing more preparation perhaps than what some people may be doing in the private sector.
The private sector is definitely much more creative and has a quicker ability to do a turnaround. For the public sector, what we're looking at is we have our human resource management systems that are all now electronic. So we no longer have the cards that used to have for individual employees. We have to remember that when you're talking about the state, you're talking about close to 50,000 different employees. That would be not only for the executive branch, but the university, the judiciary, and also the Department of Education. So combined, there are a lot of people, records that need to be taken care of. We need systems that are going to allow us to do it quickly, efficiently, effectively, and accurately.
Systems are one thing, people are another. And people being replaced by automation is the thing that we've been talking about mostly in this series. As you look at many of the systems that you need to bring in and the jobs necessary to keep those systems running, will there be a vast complement of people who will simply be outmoded and replaced by automation?
I don't think they'll be outmoded. Even our existing employees who have 15, 20, 25 years of service, what's happening to those individuals, they have a great wealth of information of how the system used to be done manually. So they're key to helping us, to advise us, how can we now transition that from a manual system to an electronic system. For the folks coming on board, clearly our more recent graduates, we're making sure that they come in with the necessary skill sets, the technology, and as well as the attitude to be able to become a lifelong learners so that they can adapt, because we know, just like in all technology, that it's going to be continually changing.
In looking over the next 15 years and looking back over our shoulder at the last 15 years, we've seen enormous progress. And given the fact that the state is concerned about money, or so it tells us, the idea that we may see people replaced by automation, especially when we have unfunded liabilities and there wouldn't necessarily have to be benefits paid for people and pension, et cetera, if they were to be replaced by automation, that's attractive to somebody who's looking at the bottom line. So as you look at those 15 years coming at us, what jobs specifically do you think people should not count on in being able to go into that department or into that job?
Well, definitely a lot of the positions that currently exist will not necessarily exist in the future. They will be redefined with a greater enhancement and elements of technology there. So the current office assistant who may be doing many of the routine types of activities, they may still be doing office assistant types of activities, but now with a computer, now with other scanners and other type of input information, so they're still going to be needed. In terms of when you say, oh, how do I see the future? Government may not be growing in terms of the number of bodies, but clearly what we are going to have to do is get much more efficient in terms of the technology and the systems that we embrace. We, the state, will not be as quick as the private sector, as they are much quicker in the adaptation to different new systems. For us, it's more that we have these large systems of databases that we maintain, whether it be for the Medicaid, Medicare programs, as well as our own employee database information. So we definitely still need the employees. We will probably not be growing in terms of as we get new programs to add more bodies, but what we will be getting is more technologically savvy individuals to be able to help us to manage those programs.
The state has been well behind that technological curve. I mean, we've heard jokes about what computers are still being in use and what kinds of systems are being in use with those computers, or being supplemented still by a lot of manual work. So, you know, the idea that technology has to come into the state is one that we've had for quite some time. But how that happens in a time where people are also being replaced by automation, where jobs that are repetitive, that have to do with research, that have to do with customer service, all those things that may or may not be able to translate into a job in the new government future, those are the jobs that we're told seem to be the ones that might be simply eliminated.
From two perspectives. One is that the employees are probably our greatest resource in terms of being able to sustain government. So we look towards training and enhancing these skills so somebody will not necessarily be doing the same thing they did 10 years ago. At the same time, we're committed to being able to provide opportunities for these people who have provided dedicated service to be able to get these new skills. One of the innovative things that Todd Nakapuia is looking at, he's our chief information officer from the state. He has a specific program where he's taking and providing opportunities for basically bargaining unit 3. These are the office assistant types of positions. He's allowing them to transition so eventually he can show them a career path where they can become a computer analyst or a programmer. So he's showing them the future. He recognizes that even within the state of Hawaii, we don't necessarily have all of the technological resources that we need in terms of the programmers, the systems analysts, and all of the other high-tech types of jobs. So what he's looking at is trying to develop our existing employees and providing opportunities. He's working directly with the University of Hawaii and now offering opportunities for recent graduates from the university. Heretofore, weren't interested in working for the state, but he's providing them such a opportunity that he's painting a picture where he can show them it's worthwhile staying with the state. He's providing them opportunities to grow in the job, to get the training. So not only can they enhance their skill sets on working for the state, his aspiration is basically he's hoping that folks like Microsoft will come in and start recruiting some of his senior branch managers and folks like that. That's what he's looking at in terms of enhancing the skills of not only the state employees, but also the total population of the state. So we do have the technological resources that can sustain us into the future.
Technological resources, again, are part of the question, but in terms of people and jobs and what that looks like in the coming years, for a kid who's now entering first grade, this is going to be a big deal in 15 years, trying to find a career that has a lot of the fluidity and flexibility and understandings of an economy which in some ways may be more of a gig economy or maybe less of a gig economy. Things have been changing and they've been just as fluid. But for people who may be thinking, I'm going to go into this kind of job or that kind of job, is there a job you tell them, don't even think about that because that one's on the list to be replaced by automation?
I think the reality is that our K-12 education, as well as the community colleges and the University of Hawaii at Manoa, are all doing a good job in terms of providing information and skill sets for these students to become multitaskers, to be able to look at problem solving and doing analytical thinking going forward. And that's what we're going to be necessarily have within the state of Hawaii. Sure, we will still need to have certain general laborers. We will still need to have certain folks that will necessarily have to be service-oriented, whether they be custodians or other key factors, key folks that keep our operations going forward. At the same time, we will still have other jobs that will necessarily require different types of skill sets. So clearly what will be happening is potentially that we may not need as many employees, but we're still going to need a number of employees to sustain our system. In terms of the private sector, they may be coming up with something that's very, very innovative, and it may take a job from 10 positions to do manufacturing, and it may come down to one position or something like that. In our situation in the state, our jobs are much more paper-intensive and database-intensive.
Some would say that means that we're already behind the curve and that there is even more catching up than that the state will have to do for that.
And the answer is absolutely. Because of the fact that it's limited resources, we try to stretch our resources as far as we can. These software programs are very expensive. At the same time, we recognize we're going to have to make those investments to transition to high tech. And yes, we are behind, but we're catching up. One of the critical areas that was just done, we just completed a major request for proposals for our new accounting and payrolling system. Our payrolling system is approximately 60 years old. So if you're talking about having Band-Aids and chewing gum kind of holding it together, you're absolutely right. So we're looking at the fact that let's make, and Todd's working on this diligently, to take our human resource system and connect that to our payroll system so those two systems can talk together. And again, we're looking at trying to sustain and make the paychecks on time and accurate in an age where, you know, some folks have had this for the last 20 to 30 years. So, yes, we're doing catch-up, and our large systems are based on old technology. But they work for now, and we could still do much more and do it better with newer systems.
Which is to say that having a job with the state probably is not going to get automated as quickly as we're going to see in the private sector. We'll be talking to those people who are working in the state or just coming into it now probably in about 5 or 10 years.
I would agree. You know, change is going to occur much quicker in the private sector. The state will continue to trudge on and make progress, giving its resources, and continually to make sure that we're able to fulfill our missions and our jobs to provide the services to our community.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
James Nishimoto is the director of the Department of Human Resources Development. He has 38 years of government service in a wide range of positions at the University of Hawaii as deputy director of the DHRD and as administrator of collective bargaining and negotiations in the state, Hawaii State Department of Education. This episode of The Last Job in Hawaii and the others are on our Facebook page, Hawaii Conversation. We'll be right back. What happens after an election? After the vitriol and deep discontent that characterized this one, how to chart a way forward is a key question. Our panel of psychologists considers how America can come together after an election that drove us apart, and if healing can happen at all. Join us later today on Town Square. We'll see you at 5.
Helping people.
It made me feel good.
Taking care of people.
It's just something that
I wanted to help.
Hi, everyone. This is Bob Wehrman. It's time for The Benevolent Mind, our quest to discover the spark that ignites giving. I've talked with a lot of generous people, and one commonality they share is their grandparents made it clear that giving is very important, and if a family business is to thrive, it must have the community's support. In 1916, the same year the Hawaii Community Foundation began, the Taniguchi family opened the first KTA superstore in Waiakea Town on Hawaii Island. Their philosophy was, if they gave to the community, it would help them grow the store. In the early days, one of the Taniguchi's uncles rode a bike through town to take orders, kind of like a modern messenger service does today. Taking the family philosophy a step further, Barry Taniguchi, along with the Fred Yokokama family, began the East Hawaii Fund, which has given liberally to many service organizations. Great things can be achieved when individuals join forces to do good. Barry says it makes a big difference, especially when the community supports you. Our program is a production of Hawaii Public Radio and is sponsored by the Hawaii Community Foundation, believing for 100 years that philanthropy is all about you.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we asked if you knew the names of the two men responsible for commercially planting the first pineapple, coffee, and sugarcane fields in Hawaii. In 1825, a Hawaiian ali'i from Oahu and the British business and his British business partner transported and started the very first plantation for these crops in the Manoa Valley. 3 years later, coffee trees were moved to Kona. The rich soil, consistent cloud cover, and elevation made the coffee beans, or maybe the coffee, thrive, and it continues to be a commercial crop. By 1847, there were two coffee plantations on Kauai as well. Now, unlike sugar, coffee has withstood the test of time and can now be found growing on Maui, Molokai, Oahu, Kauai, and Hawaii Island. The growth of the boutique market around the world has helped fuel Hawaii's coffee industry despite its small scale and geographic challenges. That success all stems from the humble enterprise begun by Chief Boki and his British partner, John Wilkinson. And that's today's quiz. And no one knew it, so we'll just keep our prize until tomorrow, and you can have another run at the Backyard Quiz then. If you've got a question for us, you can always send it in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
It's no accident that Hillary Clinton's election night gathering was held in a building with a glass ceiling, or that the confetti that was supposed to fall was made to look like shards of glass. The notion has become a cliché, but it's no less real, and most women who have risen to the top of their profession have run into some sort of gender-based barriers. That doesn't mean today's young women should have to, and that's why Oscar-winning film producer Nicole Rocklin is in Hawaii, to encourage girls coming of age in today's Hawaii to set their sights high. She's with us this morning. Good morning, Nicole.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. It's fair to assume, and I'm just assuming, that you ran into one or two barriers in your profession when you're starting out. Is that accurate?
It's accurate. I think it happens to all of us, and especially when you work on the types of films that I like to work on. And as a woman in a male-dominated field, it's a ceiling that I think we're always pushing through.
You started as an assistant to Jerry Bruckheimer, right?
I didn't work exactly for Jerry. I worked for the president of his company, but yes.
His films are associated with pretty male energy. Right?
Completely male energy. Yeah. He did one film that is probably closer to align with what we do, a movie called Veronica Guerin with Cate Blanchett, which was fantastic. Mm-hmm. But yes.
So As you ran into a barrier or two, what do you do? Do you push back? Do you ignore it? What worked for you?
I think you know, my company and my partner and I really focus on films that have a message and films that can change the world, mm-hmm. Like Spotlight did, and have the Spotlight effect. And I think we just come back to the place of focusing on why we do what we do and what we want to accomplish, and just continue to push through. I think for us and other women in our business, especially in a time where we're talking about gender inclusion and diversity, which is such an important factor in the film business right now, you just have to continue to push forward and do what you want to do to achieve the level of success in terms of affecting the world that you want to do.
You know, there was a time when directors, for example, I can think of, you know, back in the 50s, Ida Lupino was about it for American female directors. And that's clearly expanded.
Tremendously.
And with it, a change in the focus of the films that are being made, I think, because they were made by women. Do you agree?
Completely agree. I mean, my next project that I'm really focused on right now focuses around four women that happened to come together, not because they were women, but just because they're fantastically successful, driven reporters. It's another news story. Mm-hmm. And just did what they did because they're human beings and not because they were women. But totally want to tell stories about females from the perspective of women.
It often seems that the male hero genres of various kinds have been, if not played out, there isn't that much room to come up with a new, a buddy cop concept or a one man, the misfit detective getting one more shot at, what I'm saying,
all
those standard tropes. There isn't that much room anyway, I think, for new ideas in those areas.
Yeah, I mean, for us, what we do every day is we're focused on true stories. So we're really out there hunting for the incredible overcoming odds, human spirit achievement stories that we mm-hmm. can find from reporters, from fantastic articles, from other people. So for us, we're really not idea machines. We're really just focused on finding amazing true stories. And there's so many amazing stories out there that need to be told. But I completely agree. I think it's most things that are male driven these days are coming from comic books and underlying properties. It's hard to really be original these days unless you find, a way to do it and a way to tell that story.
It's almost, I wouldn't even say male-driven, I'd say little boy-driven.
Completely little boy-driven, but I think a lot of men that, video game-playing men that are focused on, I think, little boys and grown boys, grown men, typically like some of the same fare.
I never found growing up to be all that easy. I think that's
not at all.
True. And, why do it, right?
Exactly.
But at the same time, it's a very welcome, I think, addition to the movie industry because we need to find, let's use Spotlight as an example. You made an exciting story about a profession that most people wouldn't think was inherently exciting. It's obviously not like being a Navy SEAL or something.
Completely, and you would know that being a journalist. I mean, I think it's a world where what they did and how they did it. I think when we first approached them and told them our angle on how we wanted to tell the stories, and approaching them, I mean the actual journalists whose life rights we obtained, they were surprised. They're like, you want to tell a story about us? Like, why would you ever want to tell a story about us?
All we do is talk to people and tap at computers, right?
Completely, right? But they're the heroes. I mean, journalists are heroes. They're so often bashed by so many people. But the journalists in the world are the heroes that are telling stories that need to be told. And if they don't tell them, especially if you look at a movie like Spotlight, if the journalist didn't come to the story and Marty Baron didn't come in and say, let's look at this, who would have spent the time, who has a year and a half of the time and the resources to actually investigate these types of stories? And it's why we have to support places like, National Public Radio and journalists and buy your local paper and support the press.
One of the things about that profession, and there are others, but it's a profession where people in it tend to have a sense of mission. And right away, that gives you a storyline, doesn't it?
Completely. I mean, for us, when we're looking for the triumph of the human spirit and finding amazing stories, you know, I don't know what better source that you can get, that you can come to, but looking at journalists and what they're looking at and how they're looking at them, and especially, you know, outside of like the New York Times and the LA Times and the Washington Post, if you look at deep investigative journalist outfits like CIR, the Center for Investigative Reporting, and in San Francisco, and these deep investigative journalist outlets, you find such amazing material. And resources that in many ways have been untapped that we're really just focused on. I mean, we want to tell stories like Spotlight that make an effect and make a change.
Well, true stories are better anyway, aren't they, Nicole?
Well, sometimes you can actually believe that the story that's unfolding is actually not scripted.
True stories are tend to be more unbelievable than scripted ones. Go figure.
Go figure, right? Especially today, right?
Thanks a lot for coming in. Good to talk to you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Nicole Rockland is partner and co-founder of Rockland Faust, a motion picture production company. She's an Oscar-winning producer of the movie Spotlight. She's in town to talk to elementary students about the film industry and give a seminar on producing, and you can learn more about her on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Really interesting listening to your conversation with Nicole, because I don't know a woman who hasn't said at some point there was some barrier there. And what do you do to be able to go around it, to surmount it, to deal with it, or to tell yourself you have to go elsewhere?
And you know, you're going to find a way through or around that's suited to your personality.
Well, clearly Nicole Rockland has, and glad for that good conversation. Thanks.
Yeah.
For us, we are just about done. It's coming up to 9 o'clock, but on tomorrow's agenda, of course, it is Veterans Day, and we're going to talk with veteran Vic Kraft about what he says should be mandatory national service that would strengthen America. We'll also take a look at the Veterans Project.
And classical guitarist Andrew York will perform live in our studio.
If you'd like to be in touch with us, you've got lots of ways to do it. You can always call our talkback line and leave us your comments. That number is 808-792-8217. Please remember to leave us your name and also the town from which you're calling. You can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Find us on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation. Tweet me at BKOZHPR or tweet the show at HI Conversation.
And if you missed any of this show or want a past show, we've got them all archived on our website under Talk Shows for the Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Chris Vanderkirk.
I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. I'll see you later for Town Square, and we'll be back tomorrow with more of the conversation.